Welcome. My name is Mark Bauerlein, senior editor at First Things Magazine, for another podcast. Today we have Randy Boyagoda here to talk primarily about his new biography, Richard John Neuhaus. Randy is well known to First Things readers, but I'll go ahead and announce him. He is professor of American Studies at Ryerson University in Toronto. His most recent novel, Beggar's Feast, was selected as a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and was nominated for the 2013 Impact Dublin Literary Award. And he's been published to critical acclaim around the world. He's written for a variety of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the New Statesman, and Harper's, and of course, First Things. He lives in Toronto with his wife and four daughters. I myself am halfway into Beggar's Feast, and it's a great read. Randy, welcome. And our listeners know pretty well the history of Richard Neuhaus, and they read him monthly for many years. So let's just jump right in to the questions. And let me ask, why do you think Father Neuhaus, why did he affect so many people one way or another?
It's a great question, Mark, and I think the answer to that has a lot to do with his ambition, frankly, to make a religiously informed case for American public life, for, as he famously said, for politics understood in its purest form, which is to say, questions of how we ought to order our common lives together. And the fact of the matter is, over the course of his life, this was something that he pursued as a writer, as an organizer, as an activist, but primarily and through this all, as a man of God. And I think it's the fact that his first and final vocation was his call as a Lutheran pastor, and then, of course, as a Catholic priest. I think this is what makes him of such signal appeal, and also, as you full well know, often of controversy and opposition. It's because he wasn't just a pundit. He wasn't just a priest at the pulpit. It was his ability as a thinker, as an actor, to kind of move across different spectrums, always motivated by his religious first principles, but never shy of mixing it up in sectarian ways. And beyond all that, he could write really well, and he could certainly turn a fine phrase and kind of throw a few jabs at the same time.
I think that his monthly Public Square column was a good expression of that. The careful writing, the wit, the sense of proportion, knowing when to take something seriously, when to take something whimsically, but still make a serious point about it. Do you think anything about the, do you want to say anything about those Public Square columns that made them so popular?
Well, I think, if you think especially about the While We're At It section, in the 5 years that I worked on this biography, speaking to anyone who had any contact with First Things over the Neuhaus years, they invariably said that they read the magazine backwards, meaning they always went to the back pages first to see who Father Neuhaus was kind of going after.
Interesting.
And I think Mark Knoll, the great evangelical intellectual and historian now at Notre Dame, he famously told, his famous observation about this was, he said, I love it when Richard would go after my enemies, and I would hate it when he would go after my friends. But the fact of the matter is, in either case, he would go after people in a way that was, pretty funny and pretty sharp, at times whimsical. The interesting thing for me, though, and, for the purposes of writing this book, I read everything he wrote over the course of his 20 years at First Things and certainly before then. Some of the stuff, to be honest, seems a little date-stamped, I mean, it was funny at the time, but you can even tell by his later years that even Neuhaus himself was kind of getting tired of, oh yeah, here's yet another hard-charging left-wing nun celebrating Mass at a Taco Bell for me to make fun of. Like, it wasn't where his great interest finally was. And I think at times the celebrity that he gained and notoriety he gained because of those back pages worked in some ways at the expense of his more sincere and larger project, which was this religiously informed philosophy for American public life. And if you step back, that's really where his lasting value, I think, really is. And you see that more in his essays for the magazine and, of course, and in many of his kind of more substantial writings.
Well, that brings us to the big breakthrough book for him, I gather, was The Naked Public Square, which is an idea or a metaphor that has proven remarkably resilient over the years. Yes. Do you agree with that? Is what he wrote there still highly pertinent? Was it predictive in some ways?
Yeah, well, I think it was reflective and predictive, but one of the notable continuities to Neuhaus's life is the fact that he was making arguments along the lines of what he makes in Naked Public Square for years. You know, for readers who check out the biography, you'll see that the epigraph to the biography is as follows. We have to see that the priest as priest is a public person, that he is a political person. That's Richard John Neuhaus in 1967. And so one of the things that I realized over the course of writing about him as a writer was he was constantly engaged in this question of how should religion figure in public life in ways that speak to kind of the deepest convictions of the great majority of the American people. What does it mean to make a publicly available case for politics, for the inherent dignity of the human person out of a biblical sensibility without finally asking you to assent on those biblical terms, but rather on the terms of just natural reason, of a publicly available philosophy, his key phrase. This was something he was trying to get across for years on end in any number of different books and formulations. And then, Mark, 1984, it's a presidential election. The moral majority, Jerry Falwell, they are figuring in a noticeable way, at least from a media vantage, in this election. And Neuhaus comes up with this very provocative phrase, the naked public square, and it really did serve as a shorthand for the phenomenon of kind of matching forces in American life, neither of whom Neuhaus thought had it right. The arch-secular progressives who would want no religiously informed contribution in the public square, and then the moral majoritarians who absolutely wanted a biblical morality at play in the deliberative processes of our country, but couldn't make a case beyond a sort of authoritative account that you're supposed to do this because you and I believe the same thing. In other words, an almost Erastian, even theocratic account. Neither worked, and they together created this phenomenon of the naked public square, and that became the phrase that really put Neuhaus in a place of national prominence thereafter. And the phrase itself is, you know, if you just Google it, I do it every now and then just to get a sense of it. It's amazing how many ways it now figures well beyond Neuhaus's initial usage.
Were the fundamentalists or the Christian right, were they angry about the book? Did they ever make an issue of it, discuss it, that you know of?
No, you know, it's funny you ask that. I suspect it was one of those books that was more read about than read in certain circles, meaning you kind of very quickly have a sense of the book because of how much was written about it in 1984 and 1985. I mean, it was reviewed and written about everywhere. And I think what I noticed thereafter was efforts by fundamentalist leaders to engage Neuhaus, to kind of partner up with him. One of them that immediately, you know, Ralph Reed being a later day version of it, but before then, someone like Tim LaHaye, for instance. And Neuhaus was kind of cool to this, to be honest. Like I noticed in his correspondence, he was a voracious letter writer. He once received a kind of rah-rah fan letter from Tim LaHaye for you know, Neuhaus is slaying the secular dragons and the soft lefty Christians. And Neuhaus did not reply to the LaHaye's overture to kind of partner up on stuff. Because I think he didn't find this was the right model for the kind of contribution he was trying to make.
Randy, couldn't he just get with the program?
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that Father Neuhaus, obviously, he's an independent thinker. And so you've got different camps, and it's not a question of joining one of them. He's going to stick to the principles and stay with his basic beliefs.
No, and I think, you know, part of that, I think, is that he also is a bit of a contrarian, or he had a contrarian streak to him. And so, for instance, you know, I opened the biography. The preface of the biography has two features. It has him leading an anti-war demonstration service, I should say, at his church in Brooklyn in the 1960s, the height of the Vietnam War. And then, kind of more pertinent to what we were just discussing, it's an account of Newhouse speaking at a Road to Victory Christian Coalition event in Florida in 1994 in the middle of the midterm elections.
Right.
And in that case, Newhouse got up there, and you know, the crowd's going wild. It's famous, fearsome Father Newhouse here to tell us why we need to vote Republican and why this is good for God and good for country. And Newhouse got up there, and he basically tore a strip off them, saying, basically counseling them that they were fools to think that if they simply voted for one party over another, this would somehow solve the great deliberative problems of our day and create a morality that wasn't otherwise there. He basically said, put not your trust in princes. And really interesting to me is he wrote about this in the back pages of First Things. Afterwards, he wondered if anybody even heard him, right? If they were just, oh, there's Father Newhouse. Great. He's a Republican in a Roman collar. Rah, rah, rah. If they really heard what he was saying, and he seemed to wonder if they did. And then he pointed out that one person came up to him with tears in his eyes and basically said, I've been reading you for years on end. It's from reading you that I've decided to become a religiously serious person in politics. And now you're telling me that I got it wrong? And it was, I think, a moment of pause for Newhouse, kind of realizing it's not as straightforward when you're not the guy calling for this, but when you're the person responding to the call. And I think that was an important moment, I think.
Right. You know, midway through the book, you detail the episode of what was called the Hartford Appeal, which mm-hmm. is, you note that it was very controversial at the time, but it's somewhat been lost in the mists of history. Can you recount it once more for our listeners?
I would happily do so, and I would really want to draw attention to this, because for my money, Mark, this is the event that marks out Newhouse's move from left to right. We all know that, you know, he was a hard-charging Lutheran anti-war leftist in the 60s and early 70s, leading clergyman of the American left as a result. And that by the early 80s, he is emerging as a formidable intellectual neoconservative-minded clergyman of the American right. In between, really for me, it's not Roe v. Wade. It's not even the anti-communism, although that's figuring in it. It's the Hartford Declaration. So what was this? One night, with his longtime friend and collaborator Peter Berger, Newhouse rode up over drinks at a cobblestone brooks brownstone on Cobble Hill in Brooklyn. He wrote up a list of kind of everything that he thought was wrong. He and Berger thought was going wrong in kind of mainline Protestantism, the kind of softening of doctrine, a willingness to kind of kowtow to cultural pressures, an abandonment of orthodoxy in terms of ecclesiology, in terms of even theological claims, and relatedly, a kind of a willingness to kind of engage in social justice projects at the expense of religious orthodoxy, and a willingness to kind of celebrate the shock of the new, if you will, over and against any continuity with the historic past and traditions of the mainline Protestant churches. So he wrote up basically a dozen claims reflecting this. And then, as Newhouse could do, like few others, he basically got on the phone and got together a group of very prominent, more conservative-minded Protestant leaders from kind of major mainline churches, and then also from a few seminaries, got everybody into Hartford for a weekend. Notable among these was William Sloan Coffin of Yale, the Yale chaplain. And they basically came up with a series of critiques of these formulations and then published these. And this, for me, was a significant moment. Time magazine likened it to Martin Luther nailing the 95 Theses on the church door, the cathedral door in Wittenberg. This was just as significant, according to Time magazine, in American Protestant or American Christian circles, because it was basically a calling out against the dominant trends in mainline Protestantism, which were leftward and were turning the faith into more of a social service rather than a religious institution. Go ahead.
You reproduce some of these themes in the mm-hmm. book, and let me mention a couple of them so people have a
sure.
of what they're about. Theme one, modern thought, and these are themes that contemporary Protestantism had embraced, correct?
Yes, exactly. That's the premise here.
Theme one, modern thought is superior to all past forms of understanding reality and is therefore normative for Christian faith and life. Theme three, religious language refers to human experience and nothing else, God being humanity's oldest creation. I think actually the most meaningful one for me here is theme 11. An emphasis on God's transcendence is at least a hindrance to and perhaps incompatible with Christian social concern and action.
Mm-hmm. And so with those three, I mean, in many ways, I'm grateful you did that. That really does kind of provide a more sharp sense, I think, of the mundaneness and neophilia that Newhouse thought was infecting mainline Protestantism. And that, I would argue, is what really caused him to move from left to right in theological and ecclesial terms. You see, a lot of the reviews of the book are trying to make sense of his shift from left to right. And I think for those that only see Newhouse in political and ideological terms, they miss the fact that he was always a theological and ecclesial conservative. How he lived out his theology and ecclesiology in political and sectarian, cultural, ideological terms, whatever, that absolutely shifted from left to right over the course of his life, but not his first principles. And that's why I assign so much importance to the Hartford Declaration, because that was the public moment, and it led to a great deal of controversy, not least a set of counter statements called the Boston Affirmations, I think, led by Harvey Cox of Harvard. And then perhaps the most important personal event for Newhouse in all of this was that he was invited alongside William Sloan Coffin and Harvey Cox to debate the Hartford principles, the Hartford statement, I should say, at Riverside Church in New York, the historic Riverside Church, where just, you know, a few years before he had been there helping host the late Martin Luther King in an anti-war state event that happened there. So there's Newhouse in this debate alongside Bill Coffin, his good old friend from the 60s, close friends. They would play piano together in Newhouse on a broken down grand piano in Newhouse's church in Brooklyn. They marched together. They worked together in anti-war stuff. Here they are. They work together in Hartford. And partway through the debate, Coffin quite literally turns on Newhouse. In fact, that's an overstatement. He turned on him almost from the beginning.
Coffin had signed the original Hartford statement.
Absolutely. He had signed it. And in fact, I have a letter from Coffin to Newhouse, which Newhouse had in his personal files, where he wrote Newhouse immediately after Hartford thanking him for inviting him and saying how pleased he was to have been part of this and how he felt good about it, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think Coffin came under great pressure and criticism from his friends on the Christian left, kind of wondering, what are you doing signing your name to something like this? And he very publicly rejected Newhouse as a kind of, for lack of a better phrase, a kind of fellow traveler, and really marked out a difference between the two of them. And years later, I think April 2008, I think it would have been when he died, Newhouse wrote a very melancholic account of Coffin, assigning great value to him as a publicly engaged religious figure, but remembering this very sour moment when they broke very publicly. And, you know, I've read the transcript of the debate. I've seen the correspondence around it. Newhouse's remembrance was warmer than the event itself, which I think would have been really personally difficult for him.
You know, Randy, I have to read what you wrote about this moment. They're in the middle of the debate, and Cox is there. At the most heated moment, Coffin angrily interrupted Newhouse in the midst of an extended account of Hartford's claims to declare, "When you say Hartford says you," and Newhouse tersely responded that he was describing the appeal in objective terms. And as Newhouse would later recount, for all intents and purposes, quote, "the friendship effectively ended that day at 475 Riverside. We saw each other time to time after that, but it was not the same," close quote. Newhouse said nothing else about this break beyond describing it as a sharp parting of ways. That might be putting it mildly. It happened in public, in a prominent setting, and it had a sting in its combination of personal betrayal and theological division.
Mm-hmm. That's really well written. Wow.
That's you, man.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it.
So, but yeah, powerful moment here in the biography. Let me move on to the next big controversy, I guess, in church affairs, and that was the end of democracy controversy of 1996.
Yes.
What happened there, and how would you assess Father Newhouse's and others' allegations in that symposium? Well, maybe in the light of the subsequent 20 years.
Sure. So I'm sure that many listeners of this podcast will know right away about the end of democracy, importantly, the end of democracy symposium. This was a symposium set of papers that Newhouse put together in the summer and fall of 1996. The actual issue came out in November 96. And basically, the papers were all in response to a series of judicial decisions about beginning and end of life matters, and questioning whether the significance of these judicial decisions was so overwhelming that it basically posed almost ontological questions about the continued vitality and integrity of the American democratic system. In other words, to put it more simply, had an imperial judiciary basically usurped the democratic right of the American people, and as a result, was democracy itself imperiled by an activist judiciary? So that was the big question. And in 96, when this was posed, Newhouse made, I think, probably a bit of a rhetorical, not a bit of a, he made a rhetorical mistake. And that rhetorical mistake was drawing a very awkward analogy to Nazi Germany in posing these questions. And it was one of these kind of classic moments where, you know, he raises the analogy only to disavow it. But as George Will said, you know, very quickly afterwards, you know, you don't raise the question of incest in order to deny the validity of incest. It makes no sense, right? And so this issue comes out. There's a series of, you know, relatively reasonable through to more aggressive formulations and arguments in there from various people. Robbie George, I think Russell Hittinger had one in there. I think Robert Bork did. But it was the lead editorial written by Newhouse that caused all the controversy. Immediately after this thing dropped, there was a huge fight on the American right. And basically the fight boiled down with importantly, with resignations from the First Things editorial board, including Peter Berger, one of Newhouse's oldest and most cherished friends and collaborators. Gertrude Himmelfarb was another. The neoconservative intellectual Norman Podhoretz was extremely upset at Newhouse for running this and basically argued he was giving cover to kind of the bomb throwers on the left by using their tactics when otherwise they would have seemed to have left those behind as a youthful mistake from the 60s. Mm. In the meantime, this kind of led to a big media battle with people on the hard right, who often would go after Newhouse, kind of celebrating the arguments he was making. And then the kind of intellectual battle played out for months on end in the kind of opinion pages of American newspapers. And Newhouse had no expectation, I think, of just how big or how divisive this issue was going to be. It's like a Babe Ruth baseball card, Mark. You can't get a copy of it now because of just how big a deal it was. But it certainly led to his losing some friends and, frankly, winning over some new subscribers. The magazine had a new prominence thereafter that lasted for a while. As to its continued relevance, I'll point out two things. The one would be, and this certainly shows up in the biography, Newhouse's response to the Supreme Court decision in Florida that handed the election to George W. Bush in 2000. And it strikes me as one of Newhouse's less winning moments, to be honest, because he somehow managed to kind of frame that decision as an affirmation of his worries about the judicial usurpation of politics. Like, you know, he's pointing out how people are pointing this at him, saying, see, I told you 4 years ago. And then he steps back and says, but in this case, it's acceptable for the following reasons. And that was Newhouse could kind of find a rhetorical way in and out of almost anything. But in this case, it really rang hollow. It felt kind of more like a victor's self-justification. beyond that, I mean, today, certainly people would point to any number of judicial decisions, beginning and end of life, marriage, the healthcare questions, and argue that in all of these cases, we can see evidence of the judicial usurpation of politics. You know, we still live in a functioning democracy. I think the desire to put things in these kind of stark terms again and again over the years. In fact, I would argue that someone who is industrious enough could probably find any number of formulations complaining about activist judges, people complaining from the left and from the right, going all the way back through American history, suggests to me that while these worries at times can intensify, I'm very skeptical that, in fact, we have actually reached any point where American democracy is no longer functioning because of judicial imperialism. It's certainly something that's well worth criticizing and resisting whenever possible, but internal to, I guess here I'm with Bill Buckley and what he said after 96, internal to a system that we still affirm and believe in.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Randy, any initial reactions to the reception of the biography so far?
Yeah, you know, it's a generous question of yours, and I think I kind of alluded to this earlier. I mean, one thing that I would say in setting out to write this book is this is someone whose life mattered, whose life kind of intersected with any number of major events in American history, and was just a fantastic story to tell. So for me as a novelist, I was engaged that way. And as someone who also cares about the place of religion in American life, as a professor of American studies, again, I was engaged that way. And what I've really been pleased by is that while the responses to Newhouse as a person sharply divide amongst the reviewers, I would say that by and large, and more often than not, everybody seems to kind of just have very nice things to say about the book. To go back a little bit, Jim Nichterlein, a name that won't be of any, that will be familiar to everybody listening to this podcast, a longtime senior editor of First Things, full disclosure, before I finally sent it to the publisher, I sent it to Jim, knowing how closely he had worked with Newhouse, knowing how much Newhouse respected his editorial judgment, and also sensing it myself. And I asked him three questions. I said, is this book responsible? Does it get the story right? And is it enjoyable to read? In many ways, those are my three kind of very straightforward goals. And from left to right, people seem to be kind of answering yes to all of those three. Nichterlein did first, of course. So that's very good. Final thing I would say, though, is this. For people who want to see Newhouse only in political or ideological terms, those reviewers, I think finally they're getting the story finally wrong because they refuse to engage Father Newhouse at the level of first principles, right? Where his ecclesiology and his theology, I think, remained strong and constant. Obviously, they developed and shifted as he converted, but there was a through line there that you don't see as clearly with his political and ideological commitments. And so to only focus on one against the other is not to take him at his fullness. I would say for those that are interested, the best thing that I've seen as of now, you know, what are we, kind of late March, has been a blog essay by Alan Jacobs, the noted literature scholar at Baylor University, who wrote about both the book and about some of the reviews of it. And I would point readers to that or listeners to that as a very engaging response.
I think we'll close by reading some lines that you quote at the very end of the book. It was a column that appeared in First Things a few weeks after Father Newhouse's funeral. And one of the last things he says is he's addressing his readers. He begins it at the time of this writing. I am contending with a cancer presently of unknown origin. He goes on, and I'll read the last few lines here. Maybe I have, at least metaphorically, planted a few trees. And certainly I am saying my prayers. Who knew that at this point in life I would be understanding, as if for the first time, the words of Paul, when I am weak, then I am strong. This is not a farewell. Please God, we will be pondering together the follies and splendors of the church and the world for years to come, but maybe not. In any event, when there is an unidentified agent in your body aggressively attacking the good things your body is intended to do, it does concentrate the mind. The entirety of our prayer is, your will be done. Not as a note of resignation, but of desire beyond expression. To that end, I commend myself to your intercession and that of all the saints and angels who accompany us each step through time toward home. You finish by saying, Richard John Newhouse died on January 8th, 2009 in New York City, leaving its prolepsis for the New Jerusalem itself. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Mark.